Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Ben, how neat, tidy, and ordered are you?
Tim, you would know better than most people
that you are an absolute
extremely,
cluster.
Extremely neat. I can feel my wife cringing as I say this. I'm not very neat or tidy. I think I'm ordered.
Well, on the issue of order, research has indicated that in students, order has been shown to improve academic achievement. And in a US Department of Defense-sponsored piece of research, it's also been used to reduce symptoms of PTSD. Now, today, we have Simon Bailey, the man about the house, and we hope to discuss getting order into our lives from socks and underwear all the way through to communications. A little bit about Simon. He has a first career in journalism, some 17 years through the major Australian networks in both television and radio. He now specialises in digital and media strategy, crisis communications, stakeholder relations. He's worked for government as a senior advisor and now runs his own communications company. But most relevant and important is his love of cooking and organising and his wide variety of tricks and tips for use around the house. So we're going to explore that as well as the theme of crisis communications in this particular episode. Let's get on with the show. So welcome to the show. Welcome my co-host, Ben.
G'day.
And I'm Tim Curtis. And with us in the studio, we've got Simon Bailey, a.k.a. the man about the house. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're going to talk a whole heap of different things today, so I'm very excited about the variety of our little variety show. But let's start a little bit with you and your background.
Okay. So I'm a graduate of WAPA, and I did broadcasting back in the day.
And for our many, many international...
Oh, yes. The West Australian Academy of Performing Arts.
Beautiful.
My alumni include Hugh Jackman.
All right. So does that mean we can get you to sing?
Yeah, no. Let's not do that.
Triple threat?
Singing.
Double threat?
Karaoke drunk. Dancing drunk. No, just one
double threat.
Yeah,
single threat.
So as long
single
as it threat. Happens after 3 a.m., you're okay.
Anything after 2 and I'm good to go. As long as it's not video evidence.
Absolutely. All right, so back to WAPA.
So graduated that, you know, eons ago and embarked on a career in television when it was in country TV with the Golden West Network based out in Bunbury. That was a challenging and exciting experience, particularly for someone who's fresh out of university and hasn't had experience as a reporter, but also looking at issues and how government works and how police works and all the bits and pieces that goes together to gathering information and sharing it with an audience. Mm-hmm. And then from that, I was invited to join the state government and work as a media advisor. So I worked in the Carpenter government for a brief stint before the 2008 election, which unfortunately they lost. But that gave me a really great insight into the mechanics of government and the mechanics of a party, a particular party, and the politics within the politics and understanding the interface between the government and the departments and the government trading enterprises. So it was a really good backgrounding for me for when I went back into journalism to work for A Current Affair, which was launched as a local program with my friend Louise Momba hosting it, and it was a really great opportunity for me to do some producing, and then they started getting me on camera. And when that was axed, I was picked up by the national program.
Was it axed because you were on camera?
Correlation?
Short answer, yes. No, I think it was a case of the network was preparing to sell, and because it was owned by Swan Television, and we were gaining an audience, but we were up against a juggernaut with Seven in Western Australia,
yeah.
And you know, I think it served its purposes. But then I got the opportunity to work for a national current affairs program, which people either think is hilarious or are fearful of me, that I'm going to shove a microphone in their face at any given time. And that sort of set me out to sort of work with Channel 9 for a good solid 6.5 years. Once I finished working with The Current Affair, went into the newsroom and was a producer and reporter for them. And again, it was a really great opportunity to sharpen my skills in terms of being organised and finding a lot of information, because often a criticism of journalists, particularly television journalists, is that they're not smart or they don't know what they're doing or they don't really care or they don't go into in depth. But when you think about the product that you're creating, a half-hour bulletin, the journalist only has a minute and 10 seconds to share their story. That's a lot of information to pack into a short period of time. But also, every day, a journalist will be working on 3 or 4 stories. So it's not a case of them knowing in depth a particular subject or a particular organisation. You've got to know a little bit of everything, and that's where the skills come in, which parlayed beautifully into when I was tired of working in television, or it was tired of me, I moved into external relations for Western Power. And that was a very, very interesting time, because literally it's using your journalism skills in reverse.
Mm. Before we leave television.
Yes. All right. You want to go back to that?
Radio. Press just a little short rewind.
Yes. That's
one of those reverse 15 seconds icons.
Sure.
Producing in television and producing in radio. You've done both. What are the differences?
Well, I mean, the obvious one that stands out is the medium of seeing and hearing. but people think that...
Ben's laughing at me for that really
silly question. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Because I'm about to explain why someone rolls their eyes thinking, oh, duh, that's
Tim
that's
TV's
really...
the one with the pictures.
Yeah. But this is the thing, right? The challenge of radio is, believe it or not, radio, a good discussion, is talking in pictures, is creating analogies and painting a picture for the person listening. So, you know, to give you an idea, we're standing in a studio with 2 microphones. It's got purple padding on the walls. And for the person listening to this right now, gets a bit of a sense of what we can see. Well, the easy part for television is you have the advantage of having the pictures. And writing for television and producing for television is you complement what those pictures are. So that's why, you know, the camera person goes out and gets the absolute best pictures they possibly can to illustrate your story, and you have to write to those pictures. But with radio, you have to start with an absolute blank canvas, and you're just using your tone of voice, the words that you craft together, painting a picture for the person listening to it, some variation in the talent that you have that you're working with to make sure that they're interesting or relevant, that someone's getting, the person who's listening to it is getting more out of it in terms of an experience, whether they're someone who's talking about a powerful, emotive story. So radio is a little bit harder to pack in more understanding because you don't have the benefit of pictures.
I think you've just described everything we're doing wrong in the podcast show.
Now, well, here's a great example of that, because you were the movie guru, quote unquote, on a national radio show.
Yes.
Where, unlike television, where they could show a clip of the movie, you clearly couldn't do that.
That's right. It's one of the challenges of reviewing films for radio is you do have to paint a picture of the film you're talking about. And quite often during the review, I would talk about the cinematography and that style and what I was seeing and feeling, and just to give the listener a sense of what they're going to see. But also the trick is to share enough about the film to either get someone interested or disinterested without killing the plot.
Spoiler alert.
Because I remember early days when I started reviewing, I literally said what happened in the end. And the host...
Tell me it was Sixth Sense.
No, it wasn't Sixth Sense.
He was dead the whole time.
No, it wasn't that. It was a film where there was a plot twist, and I was explaining the plot twist, and I just went that little bit too far. And then I went, oh no, I've given it away. And then, you know, the presenter was Ian Cameron, and he was like, well, there you go, everyone. You don't need to see that. Simon's just saved you $16. You're welcome.
Quick segue, Simon. Mm. Top film of all time?
Oh, gosh, that's a really hard question. Number one of all time, my go-to film is Working Girl with Sigourney Weaver and Melanie Griffiths and Harrison Ford. 80s classic.
Really? That does not feature in a lot of the top 10.
No, it doesn't. People have these...
top 10 films of all time.
What am I supposed to say? I meant to say Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Something epic. Citizen Kane. Something, Citizen Kane or something cerebral.
Yep. Or Predator.
Oh, no, Predator. Well, interestingly enough, the Alien film. So Aliens is second on my list.
Yeah.
Ben, you're not getting out of this. What's yours?
Yeah, what's yours?
I really enjoyed watching Black Hawk Down the first time. There was a story behind it. You know, it was with a bunch of people who were about to go to Afghanistan, but it was a very enjoyable, I thought a very well-constructed flick.
Oh, and beautifully shot.
And yeah, you know, Little Birds taking off to Jimi Hendrix. I mean, that's got to be a winner.
Yeah.
Not that you care, Ben, but mine's Pulp Fiction.
Oh, really?
I love Tarantino.
It's
think
a classic.
That the way that he weaves that story together in differing orders, and it just kind of comes together towards the end of the movie is tremendous.
Very clever scripting.
Enough about you, Tim.
Let's not have people get too bored.
Tell me, Simon, your reflections on the evolution of journalism. We're seeing citizen journalists. We're seeing, I guess, more or potentially less fact-checked stories coming out quicker. Where do you see the landscape of journalism evolving in this climate?
That is such an interesting thing to unpack, and that's mainly because the accessibility we all have to information now on our own. We're self-guided in terms of where we can find interesting things to listen to, group chats to have on social media, and the immediacy of us all having broadcast quality technology in our hands every day via our mobile phones to be able to capture sound and pictures that can be instantly shared. The thing is, the gap that's often missing in the social realm of sharing information is perspective and context. And without perspective and context of what you're seeing and hearing, then you don't know what the facts are around it. And one of the clients we work with is a disability services provider. And a little while ago, there was a guy had parked over two parking bays in a busy shopping centre car park. And someone had taken a photo and shared it on social media. And before you knew it, people were bringing over trolleys and blocking each side of the car. But the thing is, it was a busy shopping centre and all the disabled parking bays were full. And under the legislation, a disabled person is well within their rights to park on inside of two bays to allow enough room either side of the vehicle to exit the vehicle with their wheelchair. But what no one paid attention to is that person had an ACROD sticker on their car and the context, it was taken out of context. Here we thought it was an arrogant person parking their car over two bays, but the reality is it's a disabled person who needed to access the shopping centre and the ACROD bays weren't available. I use that example because quite often we see information going out into the public realm unvetted and, you know, the army of people who are ready to pass judgment. What I see journalism's role is bringing that back to giving the context, guiding the understanding. And perhaps over time, people will realise that journalism is a craft, it's an absolute skill. And the people who are tasked with sharing other people's stories every day really, really have this ability to give you a full sense of what the picture really is. And that's sometimes what we're lacking. But the other thing is, social media has made that space really competitive. And the journalism world is trying to compete in that space for immediacy. And the problem is, sometimes they're going live with stories when they don't quite always have the full amount of information just to beat everyone to the punch. And that's always a little bit dangerous.
The other thing I find really scary is the polarisation. If you're getting curated, algorithm-driven feeds that essentially are an echo chamber, they're presenting you opinions that you already agree with.
Yes.
I mean, that's a scary world for me. I always think if I've got a black and white view on something, that's a warning sign that I don't know enough, you know, because there are no black and white issues.
Absolutely. And you can always find, I mean, if you look on Facebook, you can always see in your feed what's reinforcing your understanding of the world. And if someone has a view that perhaps could be a little bit more secular, then they're only getting reinforcement of their own community. But in having said that, there is some inherent dangers of that, you know, being so inward. But secondly, it is creating communities for people to be able to, you know, so for a really good example, as a member of the LGBTIQ community, people like me can go and find other like-minded individuals to share information with and share understanding with. And that's creating sort of sense of communities as well. So it works as a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and I imagine normalising feelings that people are having in all sorts of different areas. Mental health, PTSD is one that we've encountered through our previous work.
Yeah.
I think that is a real positive, but yeah, there's a yin and yang, isn't there?
Absolutely. And again, it all comes down to having trust in who's sharing the information with you and without an agenda. And we've never seen a time before where publications, the owners of the publications, are stepping in and having editorial control over what we're reading and seeing and hearing. And that, to me, is dangerous and defeats the purpose of having a newsroom.
let's get into the family home.
Okay, great.
And you've previously been called the man about the house.
Yes.
Now,
amongst other things.
That's probably true. Now, in the last week, I've Mari condoed my office, which is actually a mistake in itself because you don't do specific rooms. And I've used the KonMari method to my office organised. Anything that didn't bring joy,
yes.
I said thank you to them. And last night, actually, I sent them to the tip. Some interesting studies, actually, out of a place called the University of Navarra in Pamplona, Spain, where they found that neatness improves our ability to think, probably not startling, but the really profound research was that people, when confronted with basic data input tasks in a messy environment, make profoundly more mistakes.
That's probably true.
What's the Cy-Bale method? Cy-Bale method.
Oh,
how can you counter the KonMari method?
Well, I think she makes a very good point. If you don't have something in your life that doesn't bring you joy, then get rid of it. But my motivation for being clean and tidy and having things organized, which is not always the case in my current living world, is I've often seen the correlation between if things are messy around you, you know, your wardrobe's a disaster and your shoes are everywhere, it's often a reflection of what's going upstairs in your head. So I often think that if things are looking too messy around me, then I'm either distracted by thoughts and things that are traveling in my brain, or I'm just overloading myself with too much in terms of work, social life, all those bits and pieces. So for me, coming back to the basic principle of reorganization and being clean and tidy is really just simplifying your life in a physical sense. Mm. So a classic example is on Saturday, I was meant to go to the big white dinner party, and I had a million things to run around and do in order to get organized, the furniture, the outfit, the food. And at one point at about 11 o'clock in the morning, I thought, this is all a little bit too much for me. And what I'm really doing is spending my entire day stressing about what's going to be 3 hours of an evening, and I'm not enjoying it now. So what do I need to do in that thinking? And I thought, well, you know what? It's not going to be a massive loss for me if I don't show up to this event tonight. So I texted my friend. I said,
massive loss to the Perth community.
Well, clearly. I mean, the other 999 people were really disappointed, and they posted on social media that I wasn't there. That's not true at all. But my point is I reached out to my friend and I said to her, I'm having a crazy busy day. I'm not organized. I'm not going to enjoy this process. So enjoy the pre-ordered wine that I ordered for my guest and I, and I'll catch up with you at another point. And then I chose to reorganize my spare room on the Saturday rather than running around. And that was a really cathartic process because there were boxes full of stuff that I wanted to pull out and clear out and just get back to that basic sense of simplicity and organization. And I found in doing that, it was extraordinarily satisfying because I got rid of a whole bunch of junk that I didn't need. But also I spent a couple of hours just focusing on the task at hand and just quietening my mind a little bit and reorganizing my thinking around what am I currently doing? What do I get enjoyment out? What are my expectations of other people? What are they of me? And that was a really, by the end of the day, I was completely zen. My spare room looks delicious. And I had a nice period where I could just declutter my brain while I was physically decluttering the space around me. And that's what it is for me. That's exactly what it is for me.
That's really profound. Now, no, it is, I reckon. See, no. That Mary Kondo, your life, not just your house.
Totally.
I like it. Now, during your Man About the House show,
yes,
you would answer some questions. People would sort of ask you their most vexing domestic sort of related issues.
Yes.
Now, asking for a friend, of course.
Sure,
what advice would you give to someone whose wife recently described them as completely ineffective in the domestic domain?
Well, I think that this has come up a lot when I'm on the radio show. Like, I literally had a lot of wives ring up and saying, how can I motivate my husband? And the trick is, you have to find the balance of, so you can divide the tasks in the home that you either loathe or don't like or like the least. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I'm happy to vacuum clean. Like, vacuum cleaning for me is, you know, very, I put on music, it's a bit of a fun exercise. But if you ask me to do the dishes, I'm a bit like, oh, really? So in your household, divide the chores based on what you would prefer to do, and you quite often find that the other person can plug the gaps. Or your wife can be really, I mean, your friend's wife, I should say. I mean, your friend's wife. You're asking for a friend.
Exactly.
She could do it by stealth, and that is find bits and pieces of things that you can do while you're doing other things that will help her out or help, you know, you out as well. You live there as well. Things like, you know, pairing socks, like putting the unpaired socks next to you on the couch while you're watching a television program saying, can you just pair those for me? And before you know it, you've paired some socks and you've, you know, put them back in the basket. And or, you know, giving you a bit of incentive around what do you want for dinner tonight? Well, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to have your favorite meal, then I'll do all the cooking and then you do all the cleaning or vice versa. So it is a little bit by negotiation, but it's also, and you know, you can find a few things to do it by stealth.
Housework by stealth. I'm going to edit that bit out before we go to air because my friend is just stupid enough for that to work on him.
Or manipulation, whichever way you look at it.
All right, Simon, what skill can we employ that will impress our partners? Maybe the same question asked in a different way.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you know what? I think domestically, it all comes down to thoughtfulness. So if you're being thoughtful and making the space more livable for the comfort of you and your partner or your family, that to me is the bottom line. So things like when I was in a long-term relationship and my partner used to travel away and he used to spend a lot of times in hotels, and I always used to think to myself, it'd be really nice for him to come home to a beautifully made bed because he's always going to these hotels where it's beautifully resolved. So my little thing was, whenever he was coming back, I would always make the bed beautifully so that when he came into the bedroom, it looked like a hotel. And there was not that disconnect to coming to the bedroom and the bed's unmade and it's untidy and he thinks, oh, the reality of being home. It's just little things like that you can be thoughtful about the other person's needs or their experience in the home, and that makes the difference. So, you know, don't leave your cup on the counter. That's going to be really annoying, and it's thoughtless.
If it's hidden, is that okay?
What does that mean, if it's hidden?
If no one knows? So if I shove it in the cupboard and can't see it, is that okay?
Look, it gets back to that thing about my spare room, right? In my spare room, boxes of stuff and a wardrobe of stuff. So you walk into the spare room and you see the bed and you see a couple of boxes, but nothing too messy. But in my mind, I know that in the deep depths of that wardrobe is a whole lot of stuff. So I don't know. If you can live with the fact that it's shoved into a, you know, out of sight, out of mind, go for it. But if you are packing something into a space to deal with later, at some point it's going to play on your mind. Well, it is now. It's going to play on your mind. You're welcome.
I was just asking for a friend as well.
Yeah. All these friends ask these questions.
My walk-in robe is a bit of a disaster. Socks and underwear drawer and T-shirts. I seem to have hundreds of T-shirts that never neatly fit. Any tips for socks and underwear drawers and or T-shirts? My mother does say, incidentally, that if you don't wear something for 12 months,
it's got to go. Yeah.
Which doesn't quite work with my lime green safari suit. Unless I'm wearing that to the next podcast. Perhaps.
Well, I mean, Kondo has a good point when you say about bringing joy. There are things in my wardrobe that I very seldomly wear, but it would be a shirt that I wore to a special occasion and I just can't part with. If you have hanging space, don't worry about folding your T-shirts. Hang them on a hanger. That seems to be the easiest way to resolve that situation. And for socks and undies, my philosophy is, and this is completely in contrast to what I've said before, is I always pair the socks because I can't cope with having random socks floating around my world. But I don't fold my underwear. I just lay it flat in the drawer. So it's just laid flat in the drawer. You can pull it out, easy access to it. Same with the socks. I've got two drawers, one for underwear, one for socks. The socks are packed in there pretty tightly, but I know that they're in pairs and they're dealt with.
Ben doesn't have that problem because a friend of mine told me he goes commando, so he doesn't have the underwear in his underwear drawer.
They were not bringing me joy.
Oh. Look, what was that comment about us doing this naked?
from Tim's underwear crisis to great. Corporate crises.
Great, to all the breaking issues.
Yep. Let's do a quick segue.
Sure.
Our listeners have obviously got weird mental images after Tim talking
yes,
about his
we're
underwear
all fully clothed, yep. FYI.
Your current line of work, helping companies deal with corporate communications.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about the nuts and bolts of that?
Yeah, okay. Well, my business partner and I launched Council Communications a couple of years ago. And that fell out of us working for a global PR firm and the Australian arm folded. And we found ourselves with 7 clients in Perth that wanted to continue working. So how that all came about was I had gone from television and worked in a large corporation in external affairs and really really had to learn that trade really quickly because the skills are similar, but you're dealing with vast amount of information on a particular subject. So once I had spent some time working in external relations and then got offered a job to work in as a consultant, that was a whole different skill set that that I needed to sharpen. But it's all, the fundamental base of that is around journalism. And for one of our clients who has an operation in the Pilbara, they have a very safe operation, but there is a level of risk in what they do and how they do it. And the reality is, if something goes wrong on the site, we're on 24-hour call. They'll ring us up and we'll deal with the messaging. Interestingly enough, there's a common perception that what I do as a consultant is gloss or spin or create a version of the truth. But our number one advice to our clients is transparency is key.
Yeah.
So, and we always come in to say, what are the facts, what's the information, and what are the limitations as well? So quite often, if there's going to be a WorkSafe investigation or a police investigation, or it's going to become a matter for the courts, we know with our journalist background what can and can't be shared that's going to impede the investigation or interfere with the court process. So quite often when we're talking to journalists and there's been a notable event and it's getting media attention, is a lot of our discussions with our clients to say, well, let's give all this information up front now that we can, but we want to make sure that it's sanitized through, not going to interfere with any investigations or any court proceedings. So when you have that journalist lens when you're looking at crisis communications, it's really quite simple for us to come in, understand what the situation is, and effectively create communications materials like media releases and talking points, and prepare our clients for speaking on camera or speaking on radio about the incident to make sure that they know that they're well supported around what they can and can't say and what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. Because a lot of pushback we get from the industry itself is when a crisis happens that, you know, people scream out saying, well, you're not giving us enough information. Yeah. But sometimes it's as simple as saying, at this point in time, this is the amount of information I can give you. As things evolve, we will give you more information. And if you make the commitment to continue being transparent, then people will understand that you're being truthful in the situation and you are showing leadership. It's the number one thing that we say to our clients, aside from transparency and making sure you're being factually correct, is that in any crisis, you need to demonstrate you're the expert in what you do and that you are a leader in that in that field. And that's more important to show that you're in charge. And we've seen PR disasters over the years where, one of the examples is Dreamworld, the tragedy that happened in Dreamworld. And the first thing that happened was the organisation itself, contrary to advice that was given to them by their PR consultants, was to not say anything. And then that vacuum was filled by other agencies, by police, by onlookers, by people giving witness statements. At no point did they quickly come out and say, here's what we know, here's what's happened, here's what we're dealing with it. And then once that vacuum is created and other people fill it, they're no longer in charge of their message. And that's key to understanding how to be an effective communicator in a crisis is own your own messages. If you've got information, get out there and share it. If you're limited in information, give the undertaking that you're going to provide information down the track. And that all comes about too from the lens of when I was a journalist, what did I need to know? And as a journo, I wanted as much information as possible, but also I didn't want to be sharing any information that comes up in an inquest and then, journalist Simon Bailey has said X, Y, and Z at the time of X. You just don't want to be in a situation where you're creating more dramas than you need to. So that's the lens that we always put on a crisis.
So you used Dreamworld as an example of a poor crisis communications situation. Who's done it well recently?
Do you know what? It's a big example, but I would say that that New Zealand, Christchurch, the government, the federal government, particularly the Prime Minister, did a particularly good job in coming straight into the situation, understanding that there was a need for the community, understanding that there was division within the community and this could be a much bigger issue. And more importantly, the messaging is around creating safety in people's minds, and that comes from strong leadership. So we had certainly seen a clear example out of New Zealand around strong leadership, but that is really understanding what it is the community needed at the time they needed it and filling the void of information that, well, filling the vacuum, what could have been a vacuum of information that the world was asking for as well. It is an excellent example of effective communication. And the other thing that it displayed was an incredible, extraordinary amount of empathy. And empathy is key to crisis communications.
Yeah. How do you advise your clients in terms of ownership of the problem? We've seen examples potentially like Andrew McKenzie and Samarco, Tony Fernandez with AirAsia. They both seem to own the problem and display that leadership and empathy in both those situations. How far can you go with that ownership in a situation where the actual culpability may not yet be established?
That is a really, really, really good question, because I have experienced both ends I have an example that it's not a client, but there was a CEO who there was a volatile situation, and the CEO kept saying, "But this is not our fault. We didn't do this. It's not our fault." And at the time, I'm saying that is irrelevant. What is relevant right now is it involves your organization. Your organization's name has been said a bazillion times. This is the time for you to come front and center and take responsibility for the chain of events that's happened under your command. And that's the key thing too, is comes back to what I was saying before around leadership, is if you own the problem or own what's happened, and at the same time owning the solution, then everyone sitting at home watching the television will understand that you're doing something about it, or it is an anomaly of what normally are your safe practices, or you really have to make sure that you are not just coming and saying, "Oh, it wasn't me," and pointing in another direction. And I can think of a civic leader who in recent times, she pointed in the other direction and said, "It was not my responsibility." But at the end of the day, if you're in charge of the organization, everyone assumes that you know everything there is to know about that organization. And therefore, at some point, the buck has to stop with someone. And if you're the CEO, if you're the general manager, or you're the leader, that's when your communications team says, "Please step up to the plate. This is your responsibility." Even if it's just to say, "We understand that something's gone wrong. We are doing an internal investigation ourselves to understand what the problem, the cause is. And as soon as that information becomes clear, we will share that information with you." But owning the problem or owning the situation is absolutely key. Own the problem, take responsibility, but also take responsibility for solution. What is the solution? Better safety practices or better processes grounding a particular aircraft that is involved in an incident immediately, and promising that there is going to be checks and balances put in place, and a collaboration with the other organisations that will come into it, like, you know, air safety or police or the other organisations, so that you are shown to be collaborative and working with them to get the solution on the table.
So on the Venn diagram, our practice area of crisis management crosses over with yours.
A little bit,
fully respect your crisis communications path, and we certainly don't profess to be public relations experts. But we teach a module of crisis communications where we talk about designing themes and messages that can be communicated to any stakeholder, regardless of whether you choose to use the media or not. And interesting contrast, I was just dwelling on this. We talk about order in the house.
Yes.
A lot of this is about ordering your messages to be able to communicate clearly. We use a little simple formula. We say reputation equals behaviour plus communications.
That's good.
What you say plus what you do equals reputation. Thoughts
Absolutely.
On that?
Absolutely. The two have to be in sync, because people can see through rhetoric really, really, really quickly. And if you're not practising what you preach, you're going to fall down flat. It's like we always say to clients, you can never lie to anyone, because, you know, the truth is like an air bubble. It's always going to rise to the surface in water. So my point about that being is you have to walk the talk and talk the walk, and, you know, all those cliches that come to mind, simply because if you aren't being authentic and if you aren't representing what you're actually going to do, getting found out by not doing that in the long run is worse than the crisis that's happening right in front of you. So it's the old analogy that I would use is when someone, you know, when the partner complains, it's not that you had the affair, it's that you lied. And no one really quite understands that, because what you're doing is, if you aren't representing truly what your behaviour is and clearly and demonstrating that as a clear reflection of the good things you're going to do to remedy the situation, if you are, you know, untruthful about that, then people finding that out is going to be worse, because trust is absolutely key in communicating around a crisis. You have to build trust that you are a reputable source of information, even if you are saying, I'm so sorry, but, you know, if it's a tragedy and lives are lost and you're having to say, I'm so sorry, but, you know, we've lost three of our own, and we'll do everything we can to support the families, and we'll do everything we can to find out what's happened in this situation. Own it, be clear. You know, the last thing you want to do is stand up there and say, oh, you know, this was an anomaly and it's, you know, not our fault, but we'll have to look into it anyway. Or say that you're supporting the families and then you don't actually pick up the phone and speak to the families or offer your support. And then the family gets on radio and says, by the way, we were promised that we would get some comfort from the organisation and we've heard zero from them. And then immediately the perception is that you're dodgy.
Yeah. Back in the unit, we used to make a clear distinction between errors of judgment and errors of character. It sounds like a similar thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, in many cases, errors of judgment, those failures, you can use them as free experiments. You can learn from them. You can get better individually and organisationally. But when you start seeing those errors of character, the lying, cheating, stealing, that's a pretty big warning sign.
100%, 100%.
If you were to profile up what makes successful crisis communications, how would you portfolio that up?
How would I portfolio that up? Well, I think success in any crisis is creating clear understanding. So if you are communicating clearly, and people can understand it is what you're articulating to them and then repeat it succinctly, that is success in a crisis. Because quite often we see, look at the model. If there's a bushfire, it's up to DFES, the Department of Fire and Emergency Services, to clearly articulate what's happening in a way that can be easily passed on. So you hear it on the radio via ABC broadcast, then you think, right, I've got to leave because the fire is at these streets and it's this many kilometres away from me, and that gives me 30 minutes to get out of the area, otherwise it's a risk to me. You have that simple information, you call out to your neighbour and you go, mate, we're out of here, we've got 30 minutes to get out of here. If you can clearly communicate where that information can be passed on succinctly, that is success of a crisis communications, simply because you want to create clear understanding as quickly as possible, and you don't want A, the message to be diluted, and B, you don't want it to get distorted. It's the old game of Chinese whispers when you were kids.
Yep.
You know, by the time you get to the end of the 10th person, if they can clearly articulate what it is you said, the first person said, then you've done the right job. And that is the first indication that you are being successful as a crisis communicator.
It's a really interesting point, because I fully agree, within a crisis, you want that very sharp, very succinct, very clear, simple message. To our earlier conversation about polarisation of debates, it's disappointing that we're seeing some very complex issues trying to be reduced into 140 characters. And so in many ways, in the status quo type situation, I would suggest we're going too far in that reductionist approach to complex issues. But your point's very well taken. In a crisis, we need to cut through the noise.
The other thing is, and it's in a crisis, is the situation's volatile. People have an emotive reaction. People start to panic. People start going into the survival space. And as a consultant, it's our job to come in and calm everything down. And also, the second chance of successful communication in a crisis is understanding the bigger picture. How big is this externally? Which stakeholders are involved? How big is this issue going to be contained to just this incident in our organisation, or is this going to be widespread and become, you know, a national or international issue? And that is part of our work, is sometimes coming in and saying, okay, and you get the phone call at 3 a.m. and something's gone wrong, and literally come and say, what are all the facts? What's happening? Who has the information? Where do we need to start communicating? And they're like, oh, we've told this people, and we've told the regulator, and we've told, you know, and they go through the list and I go, great, you've got it in hand. Let's come back and just nuance the messages and let's have a statement ready to go. But in the meantime, can everyone just calm down and let's deal with the situation? Anything that happens outside of that will handle the noise that's in the exterior. And then everyone goes, oh, how are you so calm about it? Well, the thing is, what's a big deal to organisation that when something goes wrong may not necessarily be a huge deal to everyone else around you, or, you know, it doesn't necessarily make a media story. Or so part of that successfully communicating is not having your hand hovering over the red button straight away, but making sure that we're having just checking that the people who should know have all the information at hand.
There's a great analogy within leadership about this idea of balconies and dance floors, being able to toggle between getting your hands dirty on the immediate issue at hand, but then getting up on that balcony to see the wider choreography, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
It sounds very similar to what you've just described.
It's really interesting because in my previous job, we had a situation where unfortunately there was a fatality on a site. And while that was a frightening experience for the entire organisation and it affected everyone, particularly the people who were working closest with that person, at the time, one of the senior leaders came to my desk and said, you need to get on the phone and start telling journalists what's happening and what the situation is and making it clear that that site was not controlled by this organisation. And I said at the time, well, I don't need to do that because there's several conventions around this that doesn't make it a news story other than maybe a brief mention in a news bulletin and a small article in the newspaper. And he's like, I don't understand why that is your advice. This is someone who's lost their life. It's on one, you know, it's on a project that we're working on. This is a big deal. And I said, it is a big deal. It's a big deal from our community as a workforce. It's a big deal for him and his family. All of those things I understand is a big deal, but you're vibrating on a really high level when really from this as a piece of information to people's lives who've got the news on at 6 o'clock, it's not going to make or break their day. It makes or break our day because we're directly involved. And that conversation sort of didn't land particularly well, and he was just adamant that it was going to be much bigger than it is. And I said to him, this story will be at the 6 o'clock news, it'll be the second it'll be the second or third item after the first commercial break. It will be a small 3 or 4 paragraph article in the West Australian the following day, probably on page 5 or 6. And that's as far as it's going to go. We're not going to have cameras outside the organisation because where the incident happened also happened in a remote part in a controlled site where, you know, media couldn't get access to. Plus, it became a WorkSafe investigation, so no one could get access to the site. Anyway, the following day, the same member of the leadership team came up to me and said, what did you do in order to place that story in the bulletin where it was? Like, who did you talk to? And I said, no one. I didn't talk to anyone. I said, all I did was answer the questions when the journalist rang me and said, here's where it is, here's what's happened. It's now a WorkSafe investigation. And I gave all the information that I had at hand. And he said, well, I don't understand. Did you use some kind of influence? And I said, no. This is my understanding of how a news bulletin works and how what makes a good news story comes into play, that it has to satisfy a set of conventions. It's got to be topical. It's got to be relevant. There's got to be pictures. And because that piece of information didn't satisfy any of those conventions, it wasn't a big news story. Mm. And then we had a discussion around me saying, how about I come in and do some work with the leadership team to really talk about news values and how a story comes together? And because there was another situation that wasn't a fatality 2 months later, and I literally came into his office and I said, everyone, gather your resources. This is a big deal. And he was like, oh, but no one's dead. And I was like, no, but we're about to cop it sideways. Let's go. You know, so it's just that understanding of, you know, triaging what's relevant information to the people in your world and beyond it.
We worked with a crisis management team in the last couple of weeks, and one of the members of the team, as things are happening inside the team room, said, this is just absolutely chaotic. And our reflection on that is, your report card on good crisis communication is not written inside this chaotic room.
No.
It's written at the end of the telephone or the email by a stakeholder.
Yeah, absolutely.
So don't worry about how chaotic it feels inside the room. All you need to worry about is how crisp and clear your communications are. Would you agree
absolutely
with that, Simon?
100%. You need to demonstrate that you're in control. The other thing too is everyone, when it comes to a crisis or any communications, we're all running on the notion that there is a human being that exists in the world that is 100% perfect, has done nothing wrong, flawless, you know, perfect everything about them, physically, mentally, whatsoever. And I'm still waiting to find that human being on the planet. So the one thing you
we're
could
standing
take
right here.
So. Oh, that's right. My apologies. Oh, my apologies. Oh, my God. Anyway, aside from Tim and Ben, there are finally my search is over. I think everyone seems to forget that all humans make mistakes, things go wrong. And at the end of the day, if you show up and you say, yes, we did the wrong thing and it hasn't been ideal and this is what we're going to do about it, to any normal human being who understands that we are flawed, that we don't get it right 100% of the time, can understand and give you the benefit of the doubt. What doesn't work, though, is if it's absolute negligence and you've done the wrong thing. And that is a problem that we just, there's no amount of spin that can fix negligence or doing the wrong thing.
Have you ever sacked a client? Have you ever been at such odds? Obviously, no names, no pack drill, but...
Yes. Actually, the client that we recently declined to offer our services to, who shall remain nameless, I think in the consulting world there is a trust, as you well know. You have to build a trust between yourself and the client. You have to know that at any point they're giving you all the information you need to know, because if you don't, you can't represent them well and you can't do a good job for them. And you can't have if you can't have clear communication with your own client, then how on earth are you going to replicate that outside of that relationship? At the same time, all of this is happening. As a communicator, our brand is built on the integrity of what we do and how we do it and how we represent our clients. And if we don't have shared values with those clients, then we're not going to meet eye to eye. And I can't hand on heart send in an invoice and get payment for something that I truly can't back. But the other thing that's important with your clients is you've got to have a robust relationship. I've literally said to clients, no, you know, we want to do this in Morocco. No, wait. You can't do this, and this is why, and then step them through it. You have to be able to be pushed back, because if you don't have that robust, robust conversations and dealings on a day-to-day basis, then your client's not going to understand that you don't have their back as well, because they need to know that you have their back and vice versa.
Short answer to this one, perhaps.
I know you want a really short answer.
In crisis communications, is there any place for spin?
My short answer is absolutely not.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right, from the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts through television and news to government advisor into your own business, how important is routine and habits, and what is your working day? What does your normal day look like?
Oh, wow. Well, the short answer to that is I don't have a normal day. And also, I don't have a routine because I discovered in my corporate working life that when you're a journalist, routine is very difficult because of the very nature of what you're doing. You might get called into the newsroom at 4 a.m. You might be doing live crosses to the East Coast, you know, at 3 o'clock Perth time. And you're chasing a story and you're on a stakeout and the news has gone to air at 6 o'clock and your chief of staff has asked you to stay there until 8 o'clock that night. So coming out of that environment and going into the 9-to-5 corporate Monday to Friday just did not suit me at all. And I really struggled against it because I'm not a morning person. I'm in the evenings, the real me comes alive. And so when we started working in consulting, I just moved my routine around when I had meetings, when I had commitments, and when I had work to do, and that seemed to work really well for me. And then when we launched our own business, an average day would look, there's a spectrum. Some morning, like the other morning, I had to have a meeting with the chairman of a board for one of our clients, and he wanted to meet me at 6:30 in the morning. And I said to him, you know, I'm committed to you as a client when you see me at 6:30 in the morning. So, you know, I had to get up at the crack of dawn and have a meeting, and it went really well. Then I decided I'd go to the gym and do other bits and pieces and then get on with my normal day. But the thing that sits in what I do and how I do it is I plan around what I'm going to eat in terms of eating healthily and making sure that I've got enough protein and enough greens and all those bits and pieces. I regularly work out because it's great for mind and body. But I go with the flow, and that works for me really, really well. If I worked late at, you know, working on, you know, doing some writing, and I was working to 9 or 10 at night because that's when I, you know, really wanted to work on it, then I'll know that I can have a slower start the next day. If I have meetings early in the morning, then I'll nail all those meetings, do other bits and pieces. But throughout the day, I always take a bit of time for me as well, because if I get too rushed and too busy, my brain just goes in all directions. And that's not good for anyone. That's not good for me. It's not good for my clients. It doesn't help me to write better. It doesn't help me to articulate better. So I am one of those people, the rare anomaly, that just routine doesn't work for me. So I routinely have no routine. You're welcome.
Okay, so so night owl going with the flow, karaoke and dance only after 3 a.m. Simon, how do you define...
Oh, hang on, 3 a.m. is a bit late for me. Go,
okay, keep going. 2 a.m.
Yeah.
2:30. How do you define happiness?
Happiness, oh, I love this question. This is the best question. Happiness is comfortability in your own skin, and knowing that no matter what happens in your life, you're always, at any stage of your life, you're always going to have the resources that you need. It's just knowing that you reach out your hand and ask for help. And once I discovered that as a human, since I recently turned 40, I have found that my happiness in life has been amazing. I far more grounded. I used to suffer quite a lot with anxiety, and it was a contributor for me leaving news because it's such a high, such a volatile environment to be in. And one of the ways I looked at addressing anxiety was around exercise, around eating well, taking better care of myself, looking at what my sleep patterns were, and understanding that I'm not a 9-to-5 person. I really do need 7 or 8 hours sleep. So if I can fit that into my day, that really works for me from a mental health point of view. So happiness for me is this strange part of my life now where I kind of not too worried about what people think of me, not too worried about can I do something, just knowing that if it's something I want to achieve, I can put resources into it, it can happen. If it's deficient, if I'm not making sense of a situation, or I'm feeling uptight or anxious about it, there are a plethora of people in my world that I can leverage and say, I'm struggling with this. Can you give me some advice on this? Or what would you do in this situation? And it's just the leverage of asking for help. That's how I'm fundamentally a much happier person as a result of that. Mm.
Simon, within our show, we draw inspiration from a couple of poems. Mm. And in fact, Tim's going to ask you to reflect on a passage from one of those in a second. But I was wondering, is there any thing that you draw inspiration from in that respect? Or maybe a piece of poetry, piece of literature, maybe a line from Working Girl? Is there something that sticks in your mind as a bit of a mantra?
I wouldn't say specifically, but I know that Marie Kondo was a bit of a theme of our earlier discussion, and this whole concept of finding joy is absolutely paramount. And everyone talks a little bit about gratefulness. So one of the things I do on a daily basis is I practice being grateful. I'm grateful for the water that comes out of my tap. I'm grateful for the car that I drive. I'm grateful for the friends and family that I have. I'm grateful for finding my niche in work. And I really genuinely do love what I do and how I do it. I think that I find joy in things. So a lot of the time for me is music. Music is a go-to to find joy. And I like visual things that are beautiful. So quite often, so one of our clients is that we're working with is Museum WA, and is building the brand new museum. And two things they asked us to do. One was to come to their archives and do a tour of their archives, which is amazing.
You just jumped up and down on the spot.
I know, I did, because I got super, I was excited about that all week. The second thing is we got a behind the scenes tour of the museum under construction. And while we were at the Welshpool Depot looking at all the artifacts, some of these beautiful objects that just have the most incredible stories attached to them. And that just brought me joy. I was beaming before, during, and after. Still am. You can still tell that I am. And then, of course, when we went to the museum, and what I really like is things. I get a lot of joy out of things that I cannot do. Like I can't design a building. I can't, you know, the design elements and the thought and the attention to detail that is going into that building. And I'm not just saying it because we're doing some work with them. I'm saying I got to see it firsthand is incredible. And there's an incredible amount of joy that people will get out of that building, just the building itself, let alone the artifacts that are going to be on display there. Because it comes back to what I said, thoughtfulness. The building is so thoughtfully designed in terms of humans walking through it. Mm. It's incredible. So I know that was a very long answer to your question. It's a very simple question, but I do find joy in the aesthetic and being grateful.
So one of the poems that Ben talked about was a poem by Rudyard Kipling called If, and I've selected a section that I'll read to you, Simon, and I quite like this because it's about transcending all layers, all levels, and an ability to communicate at all levels. And the section goes a bit like this. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much. Your reflections.
It is. When I got to read this, when you sent it to me, it actually sparked a chord in me. And I think that is a really lovely reflection on balance and humility and understanding that, for me, I got this sense of it just reflects my thoughts in that you, as a human being, we are a part of a community which is much bigger than us. So my contribution to the world makes up for this beautiful dynamic picture that involves all different people and all different gifts and whatever else. So for me, it's really around understanding that you can keep your feet firmly planted on the ground, but still have a very clear view of the heavens.
Yeah, beautiful. How do people find out more about you, Simon, and Council Communications?
Oh, here's the plug. Councilcommunications.com.au is our website. We're also on Facebook, at Council Comms, and Instagram, Council Comms, on those channels as well.
Thanks to Simon Bailey. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Cheers, Tom.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60. All you businessmen, politicians, get around.